much more exciting.
If you love it, you love it. Okay, let's open the house with a new name. Committee on Rural Communities, Land Use, and Water. Today is Tuesday, February 3rd. And apparently we need to do some committee rules, maybe even before I do introductions. So let's take a look. If you've been in another committee yet, you probably went through this process already. These are the standard rules that are proposed for each committee in probably both the House and Senate. No special rules, unfortunately, for our committee that I was able to negotiate. But if you haven't yet been in one and need a moment to look over the rules, they essentially mirror what the House rules say as well. Anybody have anything they, well, let's get a motion on the table first. And we may have not briefed either of my vice chairs that they're supposed to make a motion, have they?
George, you make one.
Yeah, just move the adoption of the committee rules.
I move the adoption of the committee rules.
There you go, sorry.
Ah, here you go. We have a script for this. Chair Clem, I move to adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 3rd, 2013. I guess that's the version, but this is February 3rd, 2015.
Yeah, we're starting off well. So, Vice Chair Helm moves to adopt the committee rules dated February 3rd, 2015. And they're on in front of you with the date down on the bottom. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, with the I have to actually call the roll on the rules. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Gomberg.
Aye.
Representative McLean.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Helm.
Aye.
Vice Chair Post?
Nicely done.
Yeah.
Chair
Clinton? Yeah. I'm an aye. The motion passes and the rules are adopted. Okay, now we're legitimate. We can talk. So let's start with a little introduction of committee members. Self-introduction. I'm not going to be attempting to introduce you. So maybe out on my far left over there, Representative Gomberg. Tell us a little about yourself, your district.
Thank you, Chair Clem. I'm David Gomberg from House District 10. That ranges from Yahats in the south to Tillamook in the north and inland as far as Sheridan and a little bit of Polk County, about 100 miles wide, or 100 miles long, 50 miles deep. I'm a small business owner from the Lincoln City area, and I'm just starting my second term.
Great. Welcome.
Thank you.
Mr. Leader.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Mike McLean. I represent House District 55. It's the second largest footprint district in the state. I live in Powell Butte, work in Bend, but my district covers Crook County all the way down to basically Lakeview and Lake County, over to Medford, everything north of Highway 140 in essence, and then up through the Upper Rogue River area of Shady Cove, and around Crater Lake, and then up through Lapine into Sun River, and then around Bend back to Crook County. So it's a large district. It's full of rural communities, and has a lot of land in use in water, and so it's a good match with this committee. But this is my first time on a policy committee, Mr. Chair, and I'm very excited to be here. And to be able to, give you my thoughts on budgets as I sit here in a policy committee.
Great. Well, we're very happy to have you. As some were surprised to learn yesterday, Representative Davis was ejected from the committee, but it was not personal. He was double booked at exactly the same time.
That's not what I heard, Mr. Chair. I heard you traded for me. And I understand you give up a couple of draft picks, but I'm nevertheless happy to be here.
Great. Representative Helm?
I'm
I'm Representative Ken Helm from District 34. My district is centered in Beaverton, and it goes as far west as Rock Creek, which is a little bit north of Highway 26. It goes as far east as the Multnomah County-Washington County line and takes in parts of West Haven and Cedar Hills. This is my first time in political office, period. First time in the legislature, obviously. I'm a land use attorney by trade, which I think is the reason I'm on this committee. I hope that's helpful and not hurtful. Very much looking forward to serving.
And I'm Brian Clem. I represent District 21, which we are in at this moment. It's not exactly a rural community, but I grew up in Coos Bay, and my value system, and maybe chip on my shoulder, clearly comes from that. So I think, you know, I ask for these kind of committees and assignments, not so much based on my district, except to the extent all those public employees need healthy rural Oregon if their taxes, if there's going to be any jobs for them. And when the economy is bad, they suffer. And in rural Oregon in particular, the economy is still not good. And so it's a passion for me rather than an assignment to work on trying to improve the health of rural Oregon. And the water deal got thrown in there at the end. I don't know anything about it. I don't know if any of you know anything about it, but I'm going to do my very best to learn and navigate water law. But I am a complete rookie. I've never served on a what would you consider a pure water committee or even one that remotely touched water. So I'm going to be leaning on committee members and their experiences from their districts for help on navigating water policy. Ian, introduce yourself as well.
Ian Davidson, I'm the committee administrator for this committee. I'm coming here from the city of Lake Oswego. I was there in the city manager's office before this. And then I'm also a recent graduate from Oregon State University. I have a master's in public policy, and my focus was on natural resource policy.
Representative Post?
If you're a rookie, what does that make me?
Tied.
Oh, okay. Bill Post, House District 25, which is basically Kaiser, St. Paul, and Newburgh. I'm a little shy around microphones, so I'll try to keep it very short. I was absolutely really thrilled to get on this committee, and I understand that, unlike Representative McLean, that Representative Clem begged for me to be on this committee, and so I'm thankful that he did that.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm State Representative Brad Witt. My district is House District 31. It includes all of Columbia County. Overly simplified, that portion of Washington County north of Highway 26, and that sliver of Multnomah County past Sauvies Island that runs between the two of them. In terms of rural communities, my hometown of Clascanai is so rural that sometimes we have to go to Rainier to have a good time. In terms of land use, I have a lot to learn. And in terms of water, much of my district is in the Coast Range. We know a lot about water. And I have also served on the state's Watershed Enhancement Board, among other natural resource committees. So. I think I'm looking forward to this committee and its work.
Should be fun. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Claire Tim.
it's an honor. The first time it happens.
It's an honor to be on one of your committees again. Given what Representative Witt said, I would say we should have at least one committee meeting, kind of a field trip to Rainier.
I agree.
So I look forward to that. I'm from Silverton. There are two things about my district. I won't do the geography for everyone, but there are two important things. I represent Oregon's Christmas Tree District, but more importantly, I represent John Chandler.
That is important.
And that's a big job. I've enjoyed our work on many issues. I would have to say that I am sensitive to rural communities because I go from Silverton to Malala, but I am not by any means an expert on that highly uncontroversial thing called land use in Oregon or water, and I look forward to your guidance. and your bipartisan spirit.
Well, Representative, I did not have an opportunity to participate in your past, but I will work side by side with you towards your future. Thank you very much.
Chair Clem?
It's actually Claire Chim. And everyone's going to have to refer to me that way the whole session, or else we're just not going to move forward. Sorry, Representative Gomberg.
It won't be the last time I'm confused in here, but I just wanted to indicate for the record that while Mr. Chandler resides in the Christmas Tree District, that he vacations in the Central Coast.
In an unannexed piece of property near Road's End that he would really like to stay that way.
Hold that thought.
Okay, thank you. I am really looking forward to this committee. As you may not know, because none of you were on here before, so no one is at a disadvantage here. We will build our bonds and work together. I usually give some little idea of the way I operate at the beginning of a committee. You know, I have really enjoyed working in the legislature in natural resource areas. They often, unfortunately, are not conflict-free, and they're not easy topics, but at least in the committees that I've been on, we've always had extraordinarily bipartisan cooperation, starting when now Senator Roblin was the committee chair of the Ag Committee my freshman year that I was on. And I don't recall even then ever having a vote that was a partisan vote. We had split votes, but they were never party line votes in every session I've been on a committee related to this. And so that is my goal for this session as well. And more importantly than the votes, it's how people are treated, particularly people who have different opinions. And for the witnesses that come in front of the committee in particular, my goal is always to have them largely be unable to tell my own opinion about their issue, because the process is run in such a manner that they don't question why they only got 1 minute and somebody that I agree with got 5 minutes, that kind of stuff. So if I get out of line, you're welcome to, on the record, remind me of this statement, because I fully intend to stick to it. But when I get passionate about something, sometimes, you know, I sort of forget. So if I'm beating up on somebody, remind me of this day. And I really appreciate your service and willingness to serve on this committee. So, with that, why don't we get into our informational meeting? And I've asked the Director of Business Oregon to come and talk to us today a little bit about both his road show as he took the job and touring around Oregon, and some of their initiatives on trying to improve the economic health of rural Oregon in particular, and thought that would be a good theme for us to get started. Sean, do you want to join us? And I don't think I need to open an informational meeting.
Yeah, you do.
Yeah? Okay, we'll open an informational meeting. Apparently, after four terms of doing this, I can't remember the basics. So, great. I'm not sure I recognize who you brought with us, so why don't you at least introduce yourselves before you start?
I will.
Yeah.
Chair Clem, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sean Robbins, the Director of Business Oregon, and this is Lynn Schessler, Executive Director of the Infrastructure Finance Authority, which exists inside of Business Oregon.
Great.
And also for the record, this is my first legislative rodeo, if you will, so I appreciate being on the first day and look forward to working with you guys over the next 6 months. Real quickly, we thought we'd provide just a quick 5 minute, 10 minute overview, if you will, about the agency, who we are, what we do, for your background, share with you some of the thoughts from the state tours Chair Clem mentioned, and then some of the policy initiatives going forward that focus exclusively on scaling up our agency's focus and investments in rural economic development going forward. Business Oregon, for those of you who don't know, is the state's economic development agency, otherwise known as the Oregon Business Development Department, OBDD. You may hear it from time to time referenced as that. We're about 140 professionals working in a very diverse group of activities, from infrastructure finance to business retention, expansion, and recruitment, access to capital, innovation and entrepreneurship, global trade, exports, business finance and business services, whole range of activities that are really intended to do one thing, which is to help Oregon companies compete and to help attract new companies to Oregon to employ Oregonians. Pretty simple mission, fairly complicated set of programs and tactics in order to try to achieve that. How we do that, at a very high level for information, is a simple statement called growing our own. And that is and this is a key data point that I'd hope you could take away from this testimony today, is that on average, the data suggests that about 70% of all of the job growth that occurs in the typical American community comes from companies who are already in that community. So while a lot of emphasis and headlines and ink will get spent on large-scale recruitments, the reality is that retaining the companies we have and helping them grow actually statistically produces the vast majority of new jobs in the typical community. So a lot of our work in all of those areas I mentioned, like business finance, expansion, global trade and exports, infrastructure finance, are aimed at enhancing the state's ability to try and grow its own, and then selectively attracting and recruiting in new companies to fill in that supply chain. The simple idea that the best way to attract companies is to first take care of the ones we've got is basically the operating principle of this agency. So there's three basic ways then that we do the grow our own approach that filter out through the entire agency. Work with those companies that are in Oregon to help them grow, to help foster an innovation entrepreneurship environment, to help new companies start, and then work to recruit supply chain gaps of new companies into Oregon. And then all of those individual programs that you, if you will, that you may know or may learn over the next few months are all aimed at trying to do one of those three things in fulfillment of growing our own. Important to note, we're organized regionally. So we actually have the infrastructure finance group, the business finance group, our business development officers located and embedded in communities throughout Oregon. So we have 9 business development officers, for example, that are located in communities throughout the state. They're not centrally located in Salem or in Portland. They're actually working on the ground, boots on the ground, if you will. Chair Clem mentioned that this summer, as I took the job on June 1st, now I'm in the job 8 months, which officially means I've escaped the honeymoon period, but I still know less than probably most of you. One of the things that we thought was most important was to travel the state and spend as much time on the road working and dealing with business leaders, workforce folks, key elected legislators throughout the state, really with one simple question in mind: to hear what has our agency done really well? What is it that our agency does well that should we do more of? And what are the things that we're not doing that we ought to be doing to support local economic development capacity? Because the reality is a State Department of Economic Development doesn't create jobs. The private sector creates jobs, and we have a lot of partners that are part and parcel with that. So over the course of 7 weeks, we visited 11 communities throughout the state. We met with about 1,000 stakeholders as we went. We inventoried all of this information region by region and summarized it at an aggregate level. It's all available on our website. It's actually fairly interesting reading if you're interested in the economy, because you'll be able to zero in on parts of your community and what people had to say. But at the high level, one of the things we heard over and over again was they wanted Business Oregon, this agency, to be a more vocal advocate for business in the decision-making process and to be the voice of the economy within that decision-making process, not just an administrator of programs that the legislature creates, but an informed influencer and educator on the role of the economy in the decision-making process. And I can get into all sorts of different details about specifics of what they told us were their biggest issues facing folks in rural economies, but I'll leave that more for the Q&A. It's worth noting, as we go forward, too, that a lot of the existing work we do, despite maybe some of the conceptualizations to the contrary, a vast majority of the work that Business Oregon has done historically is focused on small and medium-sized businesses, and more than most people probably think, supporting companies that come from rural economies, not metro economies and not Portland. And I've got 2 interesting data points that I pulled before I came here. In the business development side, in our SRF programs, 64% of the SRF investments that were made over the last 2 years went to rural businesses. In the business finance group, loans, making loan guarantees, loan products, fully 53% of all the loan products that were administered over the last decade by this agency have gone to rural economies. And the vast majority of all of those companies are small and medium-sized businesses. So the truth of the matter is that this agency does a significant amount in rural Oregon, but we have an agenda going forward that places greater emphasis, makes more investments through two key initiatives that will, I believe, come through this policy subcommittee. One is the Rural Infrastructure Opportunity Fund, because we heard this time again on the road that the last mile of infrastructure can often be the last thing that gets in the way of a company who's looking to expand or relocate to rural Oregon. We don't want to let that be the case, so we're seeking dollars that would enable our agency to make those investments when there's a near-term catalytic job creation opportunity. And the other is the Natural Resource Transformative Technology Fund, a small pot of money, if you will, much like Oregon Inc., but for natural resources on food and wood, so that the same attention and resources, thinking about sort of a sunrise industry within agriculture and wood products, is just as much part of the conversation of innovation in the state as is in translational research, life science, microtechnologies, et cetera. So we have a whole package of things that we're working on as an agency moving forward that I think will be an important part of the conversation over the next 6 months. And that was probably close to 8 minutes. There's a lot to talk about, a lot to say in this space. We're excited to be doing it. We've done a lot, but I also think there's a great opportunity for our agency, as we are proposing to do, to be far more involved in trying to help rural economies than perhaps we've been in the past. With that, I'd ask Lynn Chesler, who administers the Infrastructure Finance Authority, to say a few comments about this, in large part because often where our agency's work shows up the most in rural economies is on the bread and butter infrastructure and the backbone capacity building that we're able to do through the IFA.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Lynn Chesler, as Sean referenced, the Assistant Director for the Infrastructure Finance Division. I just want to spend a quick minute talking about how did the IFA come into being. It's a creation of the 2009 legislative session, and it essentially put an umbrella over the historic community development programs that the department carried out, but they didn't have a very good consolidation or a very well-known identity. I think the IFA, if you talk in your communities, many folks will recognize that acronym and know us for the infrastructure work that we do. The other thing that was important out of that legislation is it created a board that is comprised of the constituents that we serve. So cities, counties, ports, and special districts, in addition to a few other entities, create the policy for the IFA. And so the county representative is from Jackson County, mostly a rural part of the state. The port representative is from the Port of Morrow, clearly a very rural part of the state. So we have that constituency and we represent them. The IFA manages two federal programs and five state programs. I don't think it's at this juncture. We'll have a chance, I'm sure, later in the session to go over those programs specifically. But we have municipal borrowers. And again, it's the cities, the counties, the ports, and the special districts that borrow from us. And if we have a niche at all, it's small and rural communities. Historically, the volume of our business is between $50 and $80 million a year. Last year, we did $76 million, and I don't mean to offend any of the more urban members of your committee, but 98% of that money went to rural communities, and 93% of those projects were rural. So we're really focusing on that. There's a reason for it, and it's mostly because of the $76 million, that was 68 projects. So there wasn't a lot of large projects. Small communities have a very difficult time going to the conventional public finance markets. They can't afford the interest rates. They can't afford the closing costs of those sorts of loans. And most of the rural communities don't have great credit ratings, certainly not on par with the major communities in the state. So we're the lender that deals with them most conveniently. through the direction of our policy board, I'm pretty pleased to say that when we do a loan with the community, we have no loan fees. We have no prepayment penalties. Our current interest rate for a community that really otherwise wouldn't be entitled to it is essentially the state's bond rate. So at this point in time, our standard borrowing rate for communities is 3.4%. But we've also initiated activities and practices that if a community is particularly low income, as defined by the Housing and Urban Development Department, and also has high user fees, that is, your monthly water bill or sewer bill is somewhere, and it depends on the community's income, but let's say it's in the range of $40, $50. That constitutes a high user fee. So in those circumstances, we use grants as well as interest rate reductions to make financing more affordable for communities. Just last week, last month, the IFA board approved a loan for a small community outside of Springfield. Shangri-La is its name. It's a small area. 92 people on that water system that needed a total tank and water line replacement. As a result of those improvements, even though we provided a grant for three quarters of it, their monthly water rate went from $90 to $120. So you can see what's occurring in a lot of the smaller communities. Their utility system costs are no less than the larger areas in a, you know, per unit measure, but there's a lot less people to share that expense, and so we're doing our best to make it affordable for those communities. And with that, I'll close and open up the questions that you might have about our programs.
Okay, questions for either of these gentlemen.
Thank you, Chairman Clem. Mr. Robbins, well, thank you both for being here today. I was pleased to hear you make reference a couple of times to small and medium-sized businesses in our rural communities. And I've heard so many different definitions of what constitutes a small business. What definition are you using?
You're right. There are many, Chair Clem, Mr. Gomberg. The definitions for small business vary depending on if it's a federal government, state government. It's in the state of Oregon, I would say anything under 100 employees represents a small business. Now, the federal government's definition is 500 employees or less, but if you look at where the vast majority of job growth occurs, it's in that younger, medium-sized companies, which often get thrown into that 50 to 250-person company. So I would say the sweet spot, although it's a gray area, is roughly about 100 employees.
Very good. Thank you.
I have a question.
Vice Chair Post.
Thank you, Chair Clem. Claire Chim. Okay. I know you mentioned this, and maybe I don't want to take a ton of time, but maybe a couple examples of what are the biggest issues facing rural businesses?
Sure.
Maybe just a couple examples?
Sure. So, number one, time and again, every community we went to, every single one of the 11 stops we made, the preparedness of the workforce was cited as the number one issue preventing companies from expanding on the ground. And when you drill into that and you ask, so what does that specifically mean? In most cases, it was a combination of hard skill, so some gap in hard skills, technical skills, but a vast majority of folks, businesses on the ground, would cite what are the soft skill components of the workforce. Simple things that are very hard to change, but are impacting the business community. The attendance record of new employees, the ability to pass a drug test, basic literacy and communication skills. One instance, and I won't name the specific company, but we stopped. We had this deep conversation with this company, who was, I think, representative of many of the companies we spoke with. Of all their new employees, is a wood products manufacturing company. Fully 66% of all of their new employees were turning over. Every new hire, so two out of three new hires, and those reasons I just cited were often listed as the reasons why the turnover rate was so high. And I don't believe that that company was an anomaly, because we heard it almost at every stop along the way. Number two theme I heard time and again was that the the vision for the economic development opportunity of the state matched against the regulatory environment of the state didn't always match. We have an appetite to create many high-paying, sustainable jobs, and sometimes our regulatory environment doesn't always match the appetite that we've created. I don't want to make a statement one way or another about exactly what that means, because it's probably going to mean something different to each, but there was consensus.
Go ahead.
But there was consensus, and I think that there was a disconnect, especially in rural communities. And I think, for example, one of the issues that you're tasked with on this committee of land use is one of you mentioned in your opening remarks, is an issue that rural communities cite time and again as an issue that they're facing. The availability and quantity of quality industrial land ready for marketing for both expansion of existing companies and the recruitment of new companies.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I might just throw out another one that's just as a case study, a bill that we did last year, and or maybe it was 2013 in this committee. There was a rural sort of eco, I don't know, call it eco, just tourism project that would involve building some lodging and some maybe a hotel at some point. And even in just the basics of the you know, like three or four cabins, it became clear that using the state's building code for urban areas in a rural area didn't mean the same thing. So you're building a building in town, it's not that hard to get an inspector to come over. You're building a building, in this case near Seneca, it was a several day trip to come out and just look at one little change. And so there was a goal to try and get some sort of multidisciplinary inspector so you didn't have to have a different plumbing and a different electrical and some different building code people, because that could end up delaying everything for just weeks just to get it scheduled, whereas in, you know, here in Salem it's not that hard to get somebody to come out and check the work of a remodel. There was another issue about fire code, and the fire code, which was built on essentially urban standards, and in this case it was probably a national building code that was adopted to then apply to Oregon that then got applied across the whole state, said that you needed to have certain size pipes to handle your sprinkler system. Well, in this case, there's no neighbors for 50 miles, so if something burned down, it would be your own property. And in this case, the pipes require a fire truck to pressurize them. The nearest fire truck is 50 miles away, so there's no chance of getting the fire truck there to use the new pipe before it burned down. And so we were able to give some flexibility to the director of the building codes division to be able to say, yeah, this in a rural area, this one doesn't make sense. Whereas before, there was one rule, and if you waived it, we probably didn't have any authority to waive it. So now they have some authority to waive rules that don't apply in rural areas that don't apply, and the bill passed overwhelmingly. But I assume there's lots of little stories beyond the bigger picture stuff like wages, land use, you know, whatever. There's these little things too that are crept up and hidden in all over different agencies that we have to sort of root out and try and find. And I tend to agree, even if I won't agree on every single thing that you may say is a big problem for Oregon, I think it's important you do voice those things and don't just administer programs, because we don't have as much time and expertise talking with businesses as you all should have. And if you're identifying repeatedly, even if it's uncomfortable to hear it, something over and over all over the place, I think we need to hear it from you, because those businesses don't have time to come over here and tell us all about it. Whereas at least you've got Evo, who can, you know, come around our office and talk to us on a daily basis. Other questions?
Quick question.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you both for being here, and I am encouraged and appreciate the emphasis your department has on rural Oregon. I know the honeymoon is over, but would you do us a favor, Director, just go back briefly and tell us your path to this job at the helm of the department?
Happy to, Representative Gilliam. So my background is in the private sector. Received my economics and finance degree from the University of Iowa, master's degree in urban and regional planning from the University of Wisconsin. Born a Wisconsinite, married a beautiful woman from northern Wisconsin, traded the dairy life for wheat. here. Spent 9 years in the commercial real estate development industry, mostly in urban revitalization projects in the Midwest. Ultimately, was recruited to take over a regional economic development partnership in Madison, Wisconsin, at the turn of the recession, in 2008, that is. And through that work, was recruited to the Portland metropolitan area in 2011 to take over the regional economic development partnership in Greater Portland. And then from that work, have been invited to participate here as the director of Business Oregon. So my background is in real estate. My background is in development. Understand the economics of it, but also the place side through the urban and regional planning. And to the extent possible, my management philosophy is entirely about trying to run a good enterprise, which is, in this case, about a $500 million enterprise at Business Oregon, focused on a core mission of trying to create good jobs through whatever means possible.
Appreciate that. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if you don't mind,
sure.
One of the things that Sean didn't mention was a consistent finding as we toured the state was the capacity of rural parts of Oregon to deal with all those unique niche situations that you identified that are a problem. Certainly the urban areas have professional capacity to respond to them. One of the things that challenges infrastructure development in rural areas is simply the capacity of individuals there to begin the process to make application for funding, to mm-hmm. respond to those land use issues that are unique to them when there's no professional in the community to do that. That's something that our department is focusing on as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found when we've been discussing, sometimes it's not often that, you know, an Ontario doesn't want a plan. It's the ability to recruit and pay planners to comply with the various programs that have to be in place to do the next round of planning can be challenging. So the like DLCD will end up having to fund or loan planning assistance just to get the basic planning done. And that's a real problem for them. Because, you know, we have a system that wants various work done to make sure we're growing efficiently and not wasting money, you know, laying pipes in places they shouldn't go. But somebody has to do that. And if you're, you know, as Representative Benz likes to talk about, if your swimming pool has to be traded for, you know, your next project, it becomes very awkward. And so we want to work to minimize those kind of choices. Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Robbins, when time allows, if you haven't had a chance yet, I would encourage you to seek out some of the larger companies that our state has lost in previous years and find out why we lost them. There's a story to be told there, and I think you might learn as much about what we need to be doing in order to attract and maintain business from folks who've left as from folks who we may be trying to recruit. And some of these folks are dying to tell their story because they think it was a tragedy that they ended up having to leave our state in the first place.
I appreciate that comment, Representative Wade. And one of the things, and I wrote it down because I think it's a good sort of autopsy moment, if you will, to figure it out. I will tell you that one of the highest priorities I've had since coming on board is to reach out to the CEO community personally.
Yes.
And prioritize meeting with the CEOs of the state's most consequential companies. And the reason is that while I'm single-handed, we're not a regulatory agency. So while I alone can impact, only you can, the regulatory environment, we're tasked with selling the state in a competitive global economy. One of the best ways I know how to do that, and the only way to start that conversation and end it, is to have a personal relationship with the decision makers inside Oregon companies to make sure that the headline we read one day when we wake up isn't so-and-so leaves Oregon for the Southeast United States, as one example.
Good on you. Mm-hmm.
Any further questions at this point? And we, as you mentioned, we do have a couple bills that are pretty important for the work you're trying to do in rural Oregon, and I think we're set up to hear them maybe in a couple weeks.
Yeah. Very good.
So we'll see at least Evo, if not, we might see all of you back, but at least we'll probably see Lynn and Evo if Sean's not out growing a business somewhere else that day. So, great. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair Clem.
Thank you.
And I am going to open a work session. We've got a couple committee drafts that I would like to have introduced as committee bills. I think you may have copies. The topics are sort of diverse. Some have to do with rural transit districts and being able to go over into each other's boundaries, sometimes to do a drop-off. Another one about the relationship between cities and special districts, and I can't even remember what the third one is without reading it myself. But the at least as everybody but my vice chair here may have experienced, having a motion to introduce these as committee bills in no way implies support for the actual bill itself. It's just a cog in the wheel of getting the bill introduced so then it can be, you know, potentially considered at some point in the future. But these are bills that are drafts currently that I would like to get into the process to them. I don't even know if they would come to this committee, but they're just some bills that I would like to get introduced. So with that, if there isn't any major heartburn about the premise, I'd take any questions about any of the drafts if you have any, and then we can talk about them in motion form at some point. Representative McLean.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I don't have any opposition to voting to accept these today, with the usual caveat that we're just voting to accept them as committee bills, not necessarily the substance, and reserve all rights to change votes later. Right,
exactly. So noted.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah. Vice Chair Helm.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It'd be helpful to me to understand the origin of each of the drafts. Did they come out of interim committee work, or did they, to the extent that that's known?
So 1376 and 2953 definitely did not. One was brought by, I don't know if anybody's even here from, no. The Transportation District Association. Anyway, there's a group that represents the various transit districts, and one comes from them because there's apparently a statutory prohibition about crossing into other person's district with your vehicle, but apparently sometimes they need to go in to drop somebody off, and it crosses into another transit district. And so that one came from, I don't know, it's a legal matter where somebody, you know, complained, but somehow they noted that dropping somebody off in, in Representative Gomberg's district, if there's two transit districts and one needs to go over, that would be technically illegal to be doing that. And it doesn't make any sense to the transit districts to make them stop at the border, drop them off, and wait for the next one to come and pick them up. So they would like to be kind of clarify current practice, I think. The urban service agreement thing we've worked on in the past here, but it's not an interim committee project. It's a bill really from the Special District Association. And then 1563, I need to see if I can remember what it is. Oh, yeah, this one, not an interim project, but it has to do with, particularly in kind of rural urban interface areas where there might be a jurisdiction like a city that is doing its planning and permitting for like a subdivision, and yet part of the subdivision may end up being served by a, that one's not on the list today, sorry. It's 1563.
Gotcha.
It has to do with when a subdivision might overlap with an irrigation district, and so some of the water needs to come from the irrigation district to serve the lawns of all these new homeowners. The irrigation district would like to be asked before the resources of the irrigation district are essentially called upon And right now, there is no such requirement that there is a, any kind of permission. And so they'll just find out later that there's been a subdivision approved, and they're now to supply the water to that area and didn't even know it was coming necessarily. But again, none of these bills are meant to imply that you should support them by allowing them to be introduced as committee bills. These are just a step in the process to let them turn into bills that then we may or may not, even hear some of them, and they may not even come to this committee. Like, I doubt that the transit district one wouldn't even come to this committee. I'm sure it would go to whatever the Transportation and Economic Development Committee is called these days.
Okay. Thank you very much for those explanations.
And the other one, there's a change that needs to be made still to it, so I want to get it back in better form before I ask for it to be introduced, this one.
Okay.
So with that, I think we're in a work session already. I would take a if I didn't need to before, I'll close the informational meeting, but I think I already opened a work session on top of it. So I would take a motion for these legislative concepts.
Chair Clem, I move that the following legislative concepts be introduced as committee bills: LC 1563, dated October 24th, 2014. LC 1376, dated November 3rd, 2014. And LC 2953, dated January 8th, 2015.
Vice Chair Helm moves that LCs 1563, 1376, and 2953 be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? And with the caveat that, once again, this implies no support for these bills. This is just to get it in the process so people can then consider it. I will ask the clerk to call the roll.
Representative Gilliam.
Aye.
Representative Gomberg.
Aye.
Representative McLean.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Vice Chair Helm.
Aye.
Vice Chair Post.
Aye.
Chair Clem.
Aye. The motion passes and the measures are introduced as committee bills. Okay, so last but not least, let me open a public hearing on House Bill 2047. This one definitely fits into the category of work that was done by this committee in the past. And we had a committee hearing on this, basically on this bill, in December. But again, there's nobody on this committee but me from December, so we feel free to take our time and ask whatever questions you want, because I know it's new to some of you who've even been in the session when we worked on these. I don't expect that everybody paid exact attention to every line in our bill from the short session about Washington County's land use deal. The way I would describe this is a technical cleanup of that bill that only involves things that were very technical in nature, like we accidentally called something southwest and it was southeast, and just an error, and now there's a road out there that is the southwest version, which is maybe in rural reserves that wasn't intended to be. So you're going to get to hear from all sides of the people who were having to negotiate that, to verify that I'm not lying when I say these are only technical and non-substantive policy things right now. But our goal was, if somebody has substantive policy changes or they didn't like a decision that was made, this is not the vehicle for you. You should bring your own bills. And there are at least five of those I know of coming. So this is designed to be the easy one that is only technical cleanups. And if people didn't like it, they'll be here too, I'm sure, later.
Good question.
Representative McLean.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thank you. House Bill 2047 has been reviewed by your co-grand bargain partner, Representative John Davis,
And he was here during the December committee when we heard it. We're going to hear the exact same thing here in a second, but he was here for that.
And I understand, just on the record, that he is in agreement with you that these are just technical changes?
Yes.
All right, thank you.
There's one issue that I think is going to get brought up that we'll cover that he doesn't yet know about, but it's not in this bill. It's, I believe, a group that's worried about what's not in this bill, so he won't know about that yet, but we'll hear about that in a moment here. All right. Let me start with Washington County Metro and Thousand Friends. We got three chairs. Why don't Jim, Randy, and Mary Kyle, why don't you come up?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. My name is Randy Tucker. I'm the Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. And I thought I would just give you, hopefully, a very brief sort of history of the run-up to today. Hopefully keep it within a minute or two. In 2007, the legislature passed a major piece of legislation that authorized the governments of the Portland region, the counties, and Metro to enter into a big process to establish what we called urban and rural reserves. I can talk a little bit, if you like, if you have questions about why we did that. But it had very broad support, and it passed the legislature in 2007. And what it authorized us to do is to enter into a big, long, difficult negotiation about where to designate those lands. Urban reserves are the lands that are the first priority for UGB expansion, urban growth boundary expansions in the future, and rural reserves are lands, according to that bill that was passed in 2007, that are off limits to UGB expansion for the next 40 to 50 years. So after a long conversation at the regional level, agreement was reached, and the bill required that there be agreement between Metro and the counties of the region in order to make a designation. And so that agreement was reached, but then the legal process began, and there were a number of appeals from a lot of different directions. So coming into the 2014 session, last year, a year ago, those appeals had not yet been resolved. Meanwhile, Metro had gone ahead and made an urban growth boundary expansion contingent on the decision of where the urban reserves were going to be. And legislation was brought in by private development interests, I believe, mm-hmm. to try to basically make final the urban growth boundary expansion by having the legislature validate it or ratify it or, you know, basically accept it and put it into statute. So there was a lot of back and forth around that legislation. Let's just leave it at that for the moment. Happy to expand upon that. But during that legislative session in 2014, a few weeks along, the Court of Appeals issued a sweeping ruling that rejected a lot of what the Metro and the counties had agreed to, and specifically entirely rejected what Metro had agreed to with Washington County. And so we had a couple of weeks left in the session. At that time, it was fortuitous, I suppose, and there was, I guess you could call it a scramble, but there was ultimately a major negotiated agreement that was reached and was inserted into that bill that had been introduced that happened to have a convenient relating clause. So that was House Bill 4078, and House Bill 4078 basically designated in statute the urban and rural reserves for Washington County and ended the conversation with respect to Washington County about where those lines should be drawn. The result there was agreed to by all parties at the time, and so it was brought to you and or put to the legislature, which then passed it. And so, but it was done, as I said, at the end of a short legislative session with a lot going on. And so we're here today to clean up a couple of small errors without changing anything about the intent that was of that legislation that everyone understood at the time. I should allow my colleagues here to see if they have any differing opinions or amplifications of what I just told you, but that just brings you up to today. That was okay? Good. Just want to make sure. Because, you know, we all were sort of on different sides of that discussion last session, but we're all here in agreement that this bill is just a minor cleanup, fix-it bill. So I guess I'll stop there. Jim, did you want to?
Chair Clem, members of the committee, Jim McCauley representing Washington County.
I don't know how you want me to proceed. If I go through the actual document itself, I mean, we could do that, or I could just simply
the maps.
Walk you through the maps in terms
I think
of
the maps are. Yeah, maps are the most helpful for people to see, probably.
Okay. Are they on here?
I don't know. Ian, do you know if those are on there? It would have been the file that we were
there.
Okay.
So do I just go to, what do I go to? Sorry.
So as Randy explained, what you have in front of you essentially are just adjustments.
Hold on one sec. We got to get something to display this on.
Is it, I don't know.
How is that? Because none of us have maps in front of us at the moment, so we won't know what you're talking about.
Yeah. Oh, it's in there. No, that's okay.
Oh. Stand at ease for a moment. Why don't we stand at ease for a moment?
Could I just say?
Before we stand at ease, one second.
I'm in agreement with everything they're going to say, and it's if depending on timing, I'm going to be expected to testify in another committee. Oh, okay. So I'm fine for the moment.
Okay, why don't we stand at ease? And we're back. Great. So we've got a map. What are we looking at here?
Okay. So again, just for record, Jim McCauley, Washington County. Chair Clamorous, the committee members, what you've got in front of you will be a series of maps. Again, as Randy described, this bill essentially is a correction to Scribner errors that were made in 2014 session. In some cases, there were tax lots that were not identified correctly. In different townships, ranges, what have you. So this is a mix of changing designations from designated to undesignated to urban to rural reserves, back and forth and things of that nature. But bottom line, this all reflects the policy decision that was made back in 14 under 4078. So
let's just use this one as an example so I don't have to. So basically we had an agreement that this would the line would end at Beach Road. But then when the bill got written up, for some reason, that one street got stranded out there. So we would make an agreement on a map, thinking that in the short time we had, poor Harrison could actually find every way to describe everything completely accurately by just handing him a map. And then he had to go figure out how to describe these things in legal terms, section, township, range, road, southwest. And with all the changes we made, we're down to three or four, which is pretty miraculous, actually. Mm-hmm. But a lot of people were trying to make sure. And so this would be an example where you can see where the green and the white are. That's where we, on a map, made a dividing line, except for Old Gordon Road there that just randomly got written up differently.
Right. So, I mean, the obvious intent on that one was just to make sure it was in the same reserve pattern that was surrounding it.
Yeah.
Same thing can be said by this island here at the intersection, Verbort and Purden Road. This was, I don't want to say more complicated, but the short story is the lower left-hand corner of this map was misidentified, and what it physically identified in the bill was what's in the large circle in the upper right-hand corner. So the fix is to change that back to rural reserve and to make the adjustment in that lower left-hand corner as well.
That was just a numbering of a lot error.
Same issue with this road that you saw in the first example. Again, just an adjustment to make sure that there's consistency in terms of what that road is called. Again, you've got two islands here, one at that intersection in the lower left, as well as this blip along Cornelius Pass. The clear intent here was to make sure all of that was going to be blue or essentially in an urban reserve.
That's the same one.
Same issue.
I think that's it.
Yeah. So that's really it. And I think it's a lot easier to try to describe this stuff in a map than physically trying to read the bill itself. And this took really the work of Metro's planning staff as well as Washington County and City of Hillsborough to make sure that all of this stuff was correctly narrated in the bill. Because unless you are a map maker, I can't follow this stuff, and I don't think anybody else could as well. So as far as I know, this bill is clean, and we have the same support around the table that went into actually putting together 4078.
Mr. Mary Kyle, do you want to?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Gillian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could, before we lose Randy, I had a question because of my representation of Clackamas County. Could I ask him a question before we, are you getting ready to go?
I am, but you can ask me a question, and I'm happy to try to answer it or get you an answer.
And maybe we have to go back and do this, but obviously you did something very significant that I wasn't part of, other than I voted for it.
No, thank you.
But what I'm wondering from a Clackamas standpoint is that you validated Metro's UGB with these, as well as the urban and rural reserves, as you've referred to them. Okay. Does Clackamas County have the urban and rural reserves, as far as you know? Mm-hmm. Are they formally established, or is it under a PO or something?
They're not final yet, Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam. Clackamas County has, so the ruling from the Court of Appeals rejected the Washington County decision in its entirety and remanded back to Metro and the counties one piece of the decision in each of Clackamas and Multnomah counties, I'll be corrected if I'm wrong over here. So there's one piece that is not resolved in Clackamas County, and I think Mary Kyle can probably explain the legal situation there better. But right now, we're not at the end of the process in Clackamas County and Multnomah County until we deal with the remand from LCDC. And beyond that, I think one of my attorneys or Mary Kyle are much better able to explain the actual legal situation right now. But we're not to the end of the process.
Quick follow-up. And we'll have time for more discussion on this, but the follow-up would be, if there's a future expansion of the Metro UGB, then would Clackamas, under your understanding, be eligible for expansion without those, without the urban and rural reserves?
Yes. However, the urban reserves are not final, and so we can't necessarily. I don't think we can expand into an urban reserve under Senate Bill 1011, which was the bill that passed in 2007, until that decision is final. There are other processes for expanding the urban growth boundary. However, the reason we passed Senate Bill 1011 in the first place, the reason we advocated for it and you passed Senate Bill 1011 in the first place, was to make it easier to make decisions that had support in the region, where to expand into areas that were appropriate for urbanization and to be able to consider more factors in making those decisions. So we would be back to the old system until we finalize the designation of the urban and rural reserves that is almost to the end of the process. Hmm. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, that's helpful. And great. Maybe there's more discussion for this bill or something else as we move forward, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, I think in particular what I'm thinking is, if for whatever reason, even though it's only an issue, if it doesn't get resolved before the next UGB expansion, somebody would be concerned that their urban reserves aren't eligible for consideration because of that. Yeah, I understand.
Right.
Okay. And you can leave whenever you need to. Yeah,
thanks.
Mary Kyle.
Good afternoon, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Mary Kyle McCurdy, Policy Director and Staff Attorney at 1000 Friends of Oregon. And I want to reinforce what Jim and Randy both said, that this is really just a technical bill to align the wording and the mapping, for example, correctly naming a particular road or putting tax lot 100 in its correct section. So this is technical. We urge you to pass it, and I'd be To follow up a little bit with Representative Gilliam's question, 1000 Friends of Oregon did not challenge any of the designations in Multnomah or Clackamas County, and therefore were not involved in what's going on now, but I am monitoring it. And as Randy said, the lack of resolution of it in Washington and Multnomah, or Clackamas County in particular, Washington County's resolved in Clackamas County, does not prevent an urban growth boundary into those areas that are designated as urban reserves. It simply prevents using the urban reserve designation as a justification for it. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that's, if I just muddied things or not, but it doesn't prevent going to those lands. It just prevents using the urban reserve designation until that is resolved. I can't predict when that would be resolved because we're not involved with that. I'd be happy to talk about it with you more outside of this if you'd like. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Any questions for Ms. Tim? Okay, great. We're not moving this bill today anyway. I try never to do that in the same day if we can help it in case something comes up. But is Bob Rindy? I don't see Bob. Oh, yeah, there you are. You're hidden. Do you want to come up? And Robert? So, Bob, why don't you go ahead and tell us about this, and then we'll have Robert talk to us afterwards.
Thank you, Chair Clem, members of the committee. I'm Bob Rindy. I'm the legislative coordinator, one of two legislative coordinators for the Department of Land Conservation and Development. And I just have a couple of quick remarks on this. You may already have noticed that, or maybe you haven't, there's another bill, House Bill 2458, which I believe will be in this committee. And it's identical in every way, so far as I can tell, to House Bill 2047. The long story on this is that we were asked last April, the department was asked whether we might, as a neutral party, carry the legislation to correct these minor and technical errors by the county and by Metro, and we agreed to do that, worked with the governor's office, and we got agreement to sponsor some state agency legislation that does this. We worked closely with the county and other parties and got this drafted up, and at some point, I'm not sure when, in December, the decision was made that the county would rather sponsor the bill themselves, the same bill. So you'll now have two. We don't have any pride of ownership. We never really started with this thing. We just agreed to carry it as a neutral party. Our understanding has always been that this is minor and technical corrections. In getting this thing drafted, we could not get Harrison to write a relating clause for minor and technical. I guess it's not a legal term. It doesn't have a definition. But that's really what I think all of us, as the understanding has been, that these are minor and technical corrections. No doubt there will be folks who might want to make other corrections to that, and maybe we'll agree with them. But right now, with the bill as it is, the department supports this bill, and we just want to be on the record with that.
Great. Thank you. Any questions for Bob? Okay, you can go if you want. Okay, so tell us about, first of all, introduce yourself, Robert, and then tell us about this issue you're concerned about.
Yes. Thank you, Representative Klim and members of the committee. I'm Robert Bailey, Secretary of the Board of Save Helvetia, one of the appellants. I come from Helvetia, north of Sunset Highway 26. And to start with, I wanted to indicate that we sought to negotiate a settlement 1 year before the court ruled on this matter. We've always been eager to settle the dispute with Washington County and City of Hillsborough. We were rebuffed. It cost us about $3,500 in that overture. Nonetheless, the court ruled pretty much in our favor. We collaborated our appeal with several other organizations, and it was the Helvetia land through an appeal put forward by another attorney that displayed that Washington County had misused the factors in the urban and rural reserve process and misapplying that to some of the best farmland in the Tualatin Valley. We had pointed out in our testimony for a number of years, and I think the testimonies that we provided at county and region level numbered into the 30 hearings that we went through. So we have always sought to enunciate on a fact-based level. We have sought to be cooperate and negotiate, and in the end we were cooperative participants in what became called the grand bargain. We were willing to support the redesignation of rural reserves and support the designation of undesignated in the 8B area. However, when House Bill 4078 ink was dry, we noticed that there was the boundary of 8A, which is the Hillsborough industrial area that is largely south of Highway 26, had jumped the road, jumped the highway in a stretch about a mile long. And it was not discussed during the mediation of the grand bargain process. And so we came to believe it was a technical error. And we sought remediation at the local level in August. We went to Washington County. And with their Ordinance 785 pointed it out, the slideshow that's attached to today's letter was presented to them. I have some transcripts of that hearing process. They didn't disagree that it was not an error in fact, but they called it superfluous because of the narrow strip of land that couldn't be developed. They didn't basically see a necessity in correcting the error. We are concerned because it's part of the area that we have basically watched over throughout this whole process. We don't want this technical error to turn into a pretext for any future land use action. And we have seen, you know, boundaries that are adjacent affect later decisions on lands. There are some lands that we agreed to for undesignated, the so-called standring parcels, and Helvetia Road is adjacent to those parcels, and now Groveland Drive is adjacent to those parcels. And we want to, you know, get this error corrected. It may seem like a small technical error, but for us, you know, it has substance to it. If I may, I can provide several copies of the commission testimony. Also before you is a more general letter directed to Chair Clem and the committee, and it has to do with our concerns about transportation issues that are before the legislature this session and the impact it could have on agriculture in our area. And so we just provide that out of concern.
Okay, so I didn't know about this till a couple days ago, so I spent yesterday trying to scramble around and figure out if I could ascertain, you know, what was intended during the grand bargain. And the way we wrote the bill was to designate the UGB that had already been approved by Metro as the UGB, subject to these various changes, and the changes were down in areas 7. So at the time, by designating the one that was already agreed back in 2011 by Metro, apparently we ended up designating the crossover too, because that was in there, although half the maps don't show the crossover and half the maps do show the crossover. So when we were looking at maps and drawing maps, that crossover didn't show up. So nobody discussed or debated the actual crossover during our discussions because it just wasn't on any maps that we were looking at. So we had these general conversations about there shouldn't be urbanization north of Highway 26 except in these places. Okay, so the interchange, that's going to be undesignated for transportation. The standring, that's undesignated. So we had very specific conversations about the ones we knew would be north of 26, and this wasn't on the list. The challenge is, A, I'm not sure there is a practical implication either, but B, this particular bill that we're hearing now's relating clause only is relating to reserve adjustments. So I assume the remedy you would like is to have the UGB moved back down 20 yards. This bill could not take that amendment, even if we wanted it to, because that would be not a reserve boundary change, but an urban growth boundary change. And the way our system works here is the relating clause has to be, any amendment you make has to fit within the relating clause, and a relating clause would not allow for what you're describing. So I've done enough research to figure out that this isn't the right vehicle. I'm not sure your point is incorrect or without merit about that road, but I haven't had enough time to talk with everybody about that road and why in the original UGB decision it jumped the road. I don't know. It might have been a lot more relevant then because right directly above it was an urban reserve or an undesignated. Now it's a rural reserve. So why would you still need a UGB there? Practically, you may not, but this particular bill, legislative council would not draft an amendment even if we asked for one because it doesn't fit the relating clause. So it would have to be in another bill anyway. So what I'm hoping is we can continue that conversation about this little strip in some offline, venue with some of the parties and what's going on there, and not hold up this bill over it because this one really is technical fixes, and we couldn't fix even if this is considered a technical issue. I do think that there is at least two or three bills who have relating clauses wide enough if we decide we want to, propose this. The other issue, frankly, is in general, I don't think anybody is very comfortable with having the legislature be setting UGBs or moving them around either. So unless it is part of a larger discussion about technical errors, I see most of my colleagues would have no interest in having a debate about UGBs. But in this particular case, you might be right from my research that the legislature may be the only one. So, for example, you asked Washington County to move it back. Because this UGB is designated in statute, I'm not sure they have the authority to move it back. And I don't know, I haven't read the transcript yet, but I don't think they could have even if they wanted to, because this particular UGB is set in state statute as a recognition of a particular decision at a point in time in 2011, and we can't historically modify that, and Washington County could not modify statute. So we may have to address this in statute if it needs addressed, but this isn't the right bill for it, just at a bare minimum due to the relating clause. And I would probably say, without having consulted with everybody, may go beyond technical error because we didn't really talk about that. We talked about the fact that it shouldn't jump 26. We talked about the fact that where urban and rural go together, it should be in rural. But we didn't actually talk about the old Groveland Drive. So I hope that helps outline why I'm not inclined to.
We appreciate your involvement in House Bill 4078, and we'll accept your guidance and stand ready to cooperate where we can.
Mr. Chair.
Yep. Vice Chair Helm.
Thank you for coming down here, Mr. Bailey. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had a chance to quickly read through your letter, and I can't determine in a quick read whether you also went to the Metro Council to seek a change at that level.
No. Chair Amabisca, who authored the testimony, consulted with Metro staff. Tim O'Brien, I believe, consulted with Washington County planners, coming up with the testimony that we provided to Washington County.
Okay. It would be, since you may be headed toward proposing this change in a different bill, and you'll be needing to take more time to do that, apparently. I do agree with Chair Clem that I'm not sure the Washington County Commission has any control over changing this. And the Metro Council typically has authority over the urban growth boundary, as you know, in the Portland region. It would be meaningful to me whether Metro is interested in this sort of technical type of change or not. We have a batch of, as I see it, very garden variety technical fixes to maps that will only improve the administration of the UGB in the future. Given Chair Clem's memory of the legislative history of this this minor piece of land encompassing the road, it seems like your fix is in the same category, and it would be meaningful to me to know whether Metro 1,000 Friends would go along with that change as well.
Thank you.
Okay, any other questions for Robert? Okay, great.
Thank you.
With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2047. And I think that is all we have for today. I will just mention, in terms of what's coming up, a lot of folks who have bills been referred to this committee aren't ready for their bills yet. So I apologize that some of the committees might not be full, for the next week or two. But at some point, I'm just going to start assigning their bills and hearing whether they're ready or not, because we can't wait. So some of the agendas may be a little lighter in the first couple of days, because a lot of people, aren't quite ready yet. And that always happens at the beginning of session. So I may even end up, I think we'll finish early rather than start late. If it were an early morning committee, I'd say we could come in later and do it. But in this case, we'll get you out of here early so you can get on with your day. So anything else for the good of the order? With that, I will adjourn the committee. Thanks. I will adjourn the committee. Thanks. With that.